Hi, everybody. Sorry, it's a little chaotic. It's pretty great to have such a full house for this topic. I'm thrilled. Welcome to the New York Public Library and to the spring 2014 season of Conversations from the Cullman Center. I'm Jean Strauss, the director of the Cullman Center, and it's really a pleasure to have you all here. We're especially grateful to the weather gods for holding off on the predicted snowstorm. We've had to actually cancel two programs this season because of snow, so we assumed we were going to have to cancel this one too. But as of course you know, we're here for a conversation between James Rahm and James Shapiro about Rahm's new book, Dying Every Day, Seneca at the Court of Nero. Just quickly, other upcoming programs this season. On April 22nd, we will have Camilo Vergara and Graciela Moczkowski on Vergara's new book of photographs, Harlem, The Unmaking of a Ghetto. You'll find these cards for that program on a table as you leave. And on June 3rd, sorry, did I say that was going to be April 22nd? June 3rd, Rivka Galchen and Karen Russell will talk about Galchen's new collection of stories, American Innovations. For advance notice about these and all of our other programs, you can sign up if you'd like to be getting email notices of our programs. We have a sign-up sheet just on the table outside, too. So if you leave us your email address, you'll get regular bulletins about what we're up to. I want to thank my colleagues at the Cullman Center, Marie Dorigny, Paul Delaverdac, and Julia Pagnamenta for their great work in organizing everything for this evening, and also the staff at 192 Books, whom you will have seen with books for sale just outside the room. You'll be able to buy books after the program, and both of tonight's speakers have agreed to sign them, so please do that. We're extremely fortunate to be able to listen in on a conversation tonight between these two outstanding scholars and writers. James Rahm, the James H. Otway Jr. Professor of Classics at Bard College, is the author of a number of books on ancient Greek and Macedonian history and on Imperial Rome, including Ghost on the Throne, The Death of Alexander the Great and the War for Crown and Empire, and The Landmark Arian, The Campaigns of Alexander. He writes about crucially important and highly consequential events in the ancient world, and when he was a fellow at the Cullman Center in 2010-11, he worked on this new book about the Stoic philosopher Seneca and his pupil, the young Nero, whose delusional madness led to the end of Rome's greatest dynasty. James Shapiro, the Larry Miller Professor of English at Columbia, is a leading Shakespeare scholar, an expert on medieval and early modern drama, on Jewish studies, and on British poetry, and a few other things as well. His books include Oberammergau, The Troubling Story of the World's Most Famous Passion Play, 1599, A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare, which won the BBC's Samuel Johnson Prize, and the book he worked on while he was a fellow at the Cullman Center in 2006-07, Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare, which won the Lionel Trilling Award in 2011. Jim's three-hour documentary on late Shakespeare, The King and the Playwright, aired on BBC4 in 2012. He's just back from several days in England filming even more adventurous history and literature subjects. There's a great deal more to say about both of these Jameses, but instead of taking up more time, I'm going to turn the evening over to them. Their conversation will last for about 45 minutes, and then they'll take questions. If you do have a question, please stand up and speak loudly so that everyone in the room can hear you. Please welcome James Rahm and James Shapiro.
Let's see if they can hear us. Can you hear me? Is the mic working okay? Yeah. Terrific.
How about mine? Is mine okay? Yes?
Good. I'm thrilled to be here tonight to discuss two subjects that I enjoy almost as much as Shakespeare. And those two subjects are, how do you write cultural history and biography of a subject who has left very few traces? And the other is really classical Rome, which has been so important not only for my understanding of Renaissance drama, but for my formation as a scholar and to the extent that I'm an intellectual. And it was thrilling to read and engage so many great issues that matter to me and I think matter to anybody who cares about the classical legacy, who cares about the relationship between money and philosophy, who cares about how we make sense of the past. So what I'm hoping for is to open up as many questions as I can in the first 45 minutes and then turn it over to you and have you put whatever kind of pressure on James that I have failed to put on him. I love the way this book begins. It begins with a wonderful description of who Seneca is, and I will read this. By a strange twist of fate, a man who cherished sobriety, reason, and moral virtue found himself at the center of Roman politics. He did his best to temper the whims of a deluded despot while continuing to publish the ethical treatises that were his true calling. When he could no longer exert influence in the palace, he withdrew and in solitude produced his most stirring meditations on virtue, nature, and death. Enraged by his departure, the emperor, who he had once advised, seized on a pretext to force him to kill himself. His adoring wife tried to join him in a sober, courageous suicide, but imperial troops intervened to save her life. It's a wonderful pen portrait with which this book begins. And I'll turn over to the other James, the next paragraph, which describes a radically different Seneca.
A clever manipulator of undistinguished origin connived his way into the center of Roman power. He used verbal brilliance to represent himself as a sage. He exploited his vast influence to enrich himself and touched off a rebellion in Britain by lending usuriously to its inhabitants. After conspiring in or even instigating the palace's darkest crimes, he tried to rescue his reputation with carefully crafted literary self-fashionings. When it was clear that the emperor's enmity posed a threat, he sought refuge at the altar of philosophy, even while leading an assassination plot. His final bid for esteem was his histrionic suicide, which he browbeat his unwilling wife into sharing.
I got to the end of that paragraph and I thought, Obama, first on CNBC, then on Fox News. And that is, it seems to me, the problem with Seneca. So could you share for us a little bit about where these verbal portraits come from before we turn to physical portraits that might or might not illuminate who these two Senecas are?
Okay, so both of those descriptions come right out of the ancient sources. Seneca's contemporaries were sharply divided about whether to admire or despise him. And those who admired him left a record behind in a play called Octavia, a historical tragedy, the only historical play we have from ancient Rome, which paints a glowing portrait of a sage who tried to rescue a tyrant from himself. And those who hated him left behind their legacy in a historian named Cassius Dio, who preserves all the worst slanders, all the worst portraits of a Machiavellian political manipulator. So we have these two portraits, and right in the middle is Tacitus, who is our best source for the period and who I use most extensively, who was undecided and leaves us to make up our own minds.
So it's like the Supreme Court. You have four on the left, four on the right, and Tacitus plays the role of the 5-4 decider, at least for you in this.
Yes.
So it's really a kind of joint, if you will, biographical study, which is to say it's both about Seneca, but it's also about one of the great, great historians of the period having to make sense of who Seneca was. Just give us a sense, just so we all know, what's the gap in time between the death of Seneca and each of these two traditions that paint him as devil and angel, if you will?
So as far as we can tell, the play Octavia was written very shortly after Seneca's death, maybe within 5 years, by someone who admired him because it imitates Seneca's style and for a long time was thought to be a play by Seneca because it comes down in the manuscripts as a play by Seneca.
And you don't think it is by Seneca?
No, I don't think it is. but it's by someone who imitated Seneca's style. Tacitus was a young boy, maybe 7 or 8 at the time when Seneca died, old enough that he might have remembered him, and then went on to write his annals some 30, 40 years later. Cassius Dio comes from a full century later, but was relying on primary sources, most of which are lost to us, from Seneca's own time.
But we have a pretty good sense that it's not just a century later, that it is building on an anti or a dark view of Seneca, not an anti-Senecan position, but a view that sees him as more of the Machiavelli of the ancient world than as this heroic Stoic philosopher.
Yes.
Good. Let's just complicate it one more bit by the received tradition. As a Shakespearean who's stuck with very few images of the man himself. There are 2 or 3 paintings, probably none of which are Shakespeare, that hang in places like the National Portrait Gallery. And then there is the one image we probably know is Shakespeare, besides that really awkward-looking woodcut on the opening page of the folio. And that's the one that has been described as the pork butcher, which hangs in the Stratford Church, which is just not the image you want to see of Shakespeare. And it's never put on textbooks for students because it really does look like and has been described as a pork butcher. So let's go with the 2 images we have of Seneca.
You mean the portrait busts?
The portrait busts.
The portrait busts.
And when
okay.
they're kind of known and circulate.
Yes. So since the Renaissance, there's a very striking portrait bust that was identified as Seneca simply because it portrayed an ideal philosopher, a man with gaunt face and staring eyes and a look of great wisdom as though he's staring into eternity. There's no identifying marks on it. It was labeled as Seneca when it was found, and it served as a basis for portraits by Rubens and Caravaggio and other Renaissance artists.
And when I bought my copy in college of Seneca's letters, that face was on the cover of the Penguin edition.
And still is today, because they've reinstated it after first replacing it with the other portrait.
Tell us what
the other portrait
I didn't know that.
Was found in 1813. It's a double bust showing Seneca and Socrates back to back like a Janus face.
Or like a Siamese twin. Connected in the back of the head.
Yes, the cover of my book is based on that image, but I've substituted Nero for Socrates. So how do we know that this is Seneca? Because it says so right across his chest. It says Seneca.
And what does he look like in this double bust?
And he doesn't look anything like an ideal philosopher. He looks like a businessman or a bourgeois. He's a little fat. He's a little heavy of jowl. He's bald.
He looks like Dick Cheney a little bit. He does. No, I'm not making that up.
Yes, that's actually quite good. He looks like Dick Cheney.
But he doesn't look like a Stoic philosopher.
Not at all like a Stoic philosopher. So this, we now know, is the real Seneca. It says so right on his chest. And the other is now called Pseudo-Seneca. Right?
Pseudo-Seneca is on the cover of my...
They've put Pseudo-Seneca back on the cover of the Stoic Letters from a Stoic by Penguin.
The other one, the Cheney version, wasn't selling.
The Cheney version was not selling, right.
So even though they know it's not Seneca
yes.
at Penguin, they still put that image back on.
They put it back on.
Because we don't want to believe that Seneca looked like a politician rather than a gaunt, underpaid classics professor, say. So there's a lot at stake in this book about who the real Seneca is. And my first real question is, how terrified were you of undertaking a book where the dangers are great and the sources are limited?
Extremely. I knew it was going to be an almost insoluble puzzle, perhaps insoluble, and that I was going to have to grapple with all kinds of historical problems as well as my own, you know, ethical problems about how I feel about this man. And I still don't really know. I mean, I have not solved that problem. I was very lucky to have the resources here at NYPL. And by the way, I want to thank the Coleman Center and Gene Strauss and John Berkelund and Mary Dorigny and the people who made it possible for me to write this book. Yes, it's a terrifying challenge. One reason why there is no preceding book about Seneca that tries to tell his whole life story in conjunction with his writings is because it's so damn hard to figure out.
When did you first have the impulse to write this book, even if you weren't actually sitting down to research and write it? I mean, was it an idea that you've been living with for a while?
Yes. I had been thinking about this for, I don't know, the better part of a decade. I taught a course on it at Bard called Nero and Seneca, and I tried to work through it with my students. So I knew it was something that I had to do eventually, and the Coleman Fellowship gave me the opportunity.
What for you, and I mean, I love the story, and you make it seem effortless, but there had to be moments in the composition of this book where you must have thrown up your hands in despair, because you're going to have to make, you know, you're going to have to make a judgment call at a certain point. The player is rounding third, sliding to home. There's a cloud of dust. You have to decide which of those Senecas that you and I took a turn at describing is closest to the truth. So was there a moment of crisis in the writing of this book, or was it just pushing a rock uphill most of the way?
I'd say it was more like pushing a rock uphill. I left a lot of questions open and didn't make that call. I left it to the reader, essentially, to make a lot of those calls because, number one, the evidence is not substantial enough in a lot of cases. And number two, it's so much of a personal thing, you know, how you regard a man's character, how you judge a man. So I made a few calls, but ultimately I left the decisions open.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the relationship that's really at the heart of this project? That is to say, a relationship of which there are traces between Seneca and the student he took on when that student was, I guess, 12 years old, Nero.
Yes. So Nero was more or less a fatherless child. He lost his father very young. His mother was a very powerful and manipulative woman who he was somewhat terrified of. He was clearly the heir apparent to take over the empire from Claudius, who was going to be his mentor. He needed a senior figure, a male figure, to guide him into power. And Agrippina, his mother, selected Seneca because of his great reputation as a writer and as a thinker. He would cast a kind of glow on Nero that would make him unassailable, even though he was only 16 years old. He would be able to hold power and command respect.
And what was Seneca supposed to teach him?
Well, not philosophy, strangely enough. Agrippina didn't like her boy learning philosophy. She thought it was effeminate. She wanted him to learn practical skills like rhetoric and statecraft, the things he would need to wield power. And she wanted Seneca especially to write his speeches. Nero was the first Roman emperor to have a speechwriter. All the previous ones had written their own speeches. And Seneca was clearly more eloquent, more persuasive than Nero would ever be. So he was, in addition to all his other jobs, he was the royal speechwriter.
Put yourself in Seneca's mind. This is not a job offer you can easily turn down, I suppose, and live for very long in Neronian Rome. When does it get sticky for him?
The first year seems to have gone fairly smoothly. First year when Nero was in power, which was 54, the end of 54 AD, beginning of 55. And there was a kind of troika in the palace formed by Seneca as surrogate father, Agrippina as mother, and Nero as adoring son. And as long as the three of them got along well, things went fine. But Nero and Agrippina started to drift apart and come into conflict. And at that point, Seneca had to make a choice whose side he was on. And he had to side with Nero. He figured Nero would ultimately win in any such contest. And At that point, things began to go very badly and get very dangerous. Agrippina became very dangerous first, and then later Nero.
It has the makings of a novel as much as it does as a piece of cultural history. Is there a point where Seneca probably wishes he could get out of this wonderful job?
Yes, and he tried twice. If there's one thing that really exonerates him, is that he tried to get out of politics when he saw that he could no longer influence Nero, that his job essentially was done. But Nero had come to rely on the moral authority that he got from having Seneca in his administration and refused to let him go. Seneca was willing to give him his entire estate, which was at the time one of the, probably the largest estate in Rome. And Nero refused it because he said, if I accept this money, people won't chalk it up to your generosity, they'll chalk it up to my cruelty. And so Seneca had to just toil on.
So how do you get out? How do you extricate yourself if you are put in this position?
You can't. You can't. And Seneca tried to show his readership in a couple of his works in covert ways because he couldn't address the topic openly. But he tried to show that it was really impossible for him to get out. All right.
And this is where the book really, for me, gets exciting about. You describe it. I don't think you use the word covert in the book, but that's a very apt description of how we read what Seneca has written and also how we read what Seneca never wrote. Maybe it's best to begin with the kind of things that Seneca never wrote, and then we can move to what he actually wrote and how we might reread, or how you are offering, in a way, a new way of reading, especially the late tragedy, Thyestes, if I'm pronouncing that right. A book that so near and dear to me, anybody who studies Renaissance literature knows that that is one of the most formative works on Kidd, Shakespeare, all the early Renaissance tragedians. So it was fun for me to see the pressures that helped form that work and what might be behind it. But first, tell us about what Seneca apparently didn't write.
Well, he hardly ever mentioned Nero.
Which is not easy to do.
It's not easy to do. No, he spent 15 years hand in glove with Nero, and only mentions him incidentally in two or three of his works. It's an astounding silence, as well as Agrippina, who he never mentions in his extant works, and the other members of the inner circle rarely, if ever, appear. He talked about history from before the time when he came on the scene. He's full of stories about Caligula. He's full of stories about Claudius. But he stays mum about his own generation of leaders and his own role in politics.
What does he write during this fraught period where he is holding on to the tiger's tail, if you will?
Well, he's writing moral philosophy much of the time. Essays on anger, on mercy, on the good life, moral topics of that kind. He's also writing tragedy. He alluded to Thyestes, which is also my personal favorite. But he also has a Medea, which is very famous, a Phaedra, an Agamemnon. He's got a lot of important tragedies. And he has a comic work, strangely enough. He never shows much sense of humor in his other writings, but in a work called Apocolicantosis, which means vaguely pumpkinification, he did indulge in satire and had a good laugh at the expense of Claudius, who was recently dead. So
safely dead.
Safely dead. Safely out of the picture. So he has an immense range of literary styles and voices, really unparalleled today by any modern writer that I can think of. Simply to write prose and verse with such dexterity is really rare. But one might compare Shakespeare in terms of mastery of comic and tragic modes. But prose and verse, one can hardly think of any parallels.
So there are three ways of reading Seneca's work now after my engagement with your book. One is that the man was a complete moral coward, refusing to confront the very things that his philosophy would have compelled him to write about. The next version, and you could take any of these and tell me what you think of each one. The next one is that he is the greatest compartmentalizer in the history of those of us who compartmentalize. It's 9 a.m. I'm going to write philosophy and block out the world for another 3 hours. And then at noon, I have to deal with that wicked Queen Agrippina and her insane Nero, who I am tied to the hip with. But that's just in the afternoon. And the two really are separated. They never actually come into contact with each other. And the third, I can imagine a student of yours at Bard when you taught this class saying, this man is the biggest hypocrite in the world. Why are you having us read this? And why isn't this really the truth about the classical tradition, and it has all been whitewashed and sanitized, and you are participating in the process of sanitizing people who were utter hypocrites, took the money, and sold books of philosophy to raise their reputation? So how do you handle these three versions of...
You've taken my two and made them three. Now it's even harder.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's some truth in all of those, and the word hypocrite comes up frequently, and I quote Robert Hughes using that word, but I don't use it myself, and I'm not sure why I shy away from it, because it could so easily be applied, but...
It's too easy, in a way.
It's too easy, and, you know, I'd say rather than hypocrite, he was a man who naively believed that he could have it both ways. Maybe there's a fine distinction between
those
two.
This is the fourth Seneca. Thing.
You know, he had a huge fortune, and at the same time wrote about the virtues of poverty and the insidious effect of wealth. And someone pointed this out in the Roman Senate and said, you know, what kind of moral philosophy allows you to accumulate 300 million sesterces? And he wrote a vicious reply, essentially claiming, I'm not a virtuous man. You may think I am, but I'm not. I'm trying to become one, but I'm not there yet. So therefore, I'm not at the stage where I need to divest myself of money.
This was, by the way, for me, the Henry Kissinger moment in the book. And the two men are about as smart, I would say. So
yes.
I really felt that.
Yes. Well, I've actually used Henry Kissinger as an analog myself. Someone very smart, very verbal, who wants to have it both ways, and sometimes can get away with it because the word, the command of the written word is so exquisite that you can actually navigate some of these, you know, polarities. But with money, I think he finally couldn't. I think that was just finally too much.
That a philosopher can't be rich.
That you can't that write rich. About riches. He could have justified his wealth in other terms that he did. But instead, he chose to be hard-nosed in rejecting wealth in his writings and yet accumulating it in his life. And so that is the place where he really does, where the term hypocrite most applies. In other respects, you know, for example, in his use of power, I think Thyestes is his attempt to deal with the contradictions in his own life. And in the play, he portrays Thyestes as a philosopher.
Right, and pause for a second. Where does Thyestes come in the trajectory of his life, his career, and his fraught relationship with Nero?
Okay, so Thyestes is probably his latest complete play. It almost certainly comes in the 60s, during the time when he's serving Nero, but things have gone very bad, and he's foreseeing a time when he's going to have to either get out of politics or be killed.
Really right up against the end of the career where the kind of moral, let's say, dodges or equivocation might be another word that we could introduce here, are basically spent strategies. And if he is going to write, as you call it, covertly, this is the work that is going to be the place where he does that.
Exactly. So he configures a relationship between two brothers, Atreus and Thyestes. One of them is a despot from hell, who, you know, bloody-minded tyrant, and the other is a peaceful sage who has gone away to be in a philosophic retirement. But he's come back. And why has he come back? Because Atreus, his brother, has offered him a share of rule. And even as he comes back, he says he doesn't want it. but we later discover as the play goes on that he secretly does. And once he's got it, he becomes the monster that he was, that his brother is in sort of miniature. And that to me has to be an autobiographical portrait. It has to have resonance with Seneca's own crisis that he knew ultimately he wanted power, even though he knew it was bad for him, and that he was better off outside it, but something lured him back in. He probably couldn't even say what it was.
What I love about, and this is really, in a way, the solution, if you will, to the unsolvable problem of who Seneca was. What he's left us, regardless of whether we take the gaunt philosopher or the Dick Cheney image, in the end, what he's done is left us a body of writing, both moral philosophy and great tragedy. And if I'm going to compartmentalize, I can set aside whatever sins Seneca accumulated during his life and say that this work is a work of genius. It's a work of lasting influence, but it's probably been misread or misunderstood by posterity. Is that the way you read Thyestes?
I think a lot of other people besides me have felt the biographical element in it, have felt that there was a cri de coeur that was trying to come out, and this was the only way it could come out in a mythic drama, in a drama that was not in any way tied to contemporary life. And by the way, his tragedies were not necessarily put on stage, nor do we even know that they were circulated in his lifetime. So it's quite possible that these were really covert documents stuck in a desk drawer somewhere and never shown to the public.
So it's closet drama in his own day, but afterwards it becomes a popular central Renaissance work.
Yes, quite possibly. We just don't know. But no one in his time makes any reference to it. He never makes reference to it in his other works. It's as if, you know, talking about compartmentalize, this was something he really did on the side, perhaps in secret. So, yes, other readers of it have sensed the biographical element. I just brought it out a little more fully than they did.
You know, we live in a culture that is hard on writers. I can't teach Ezra Pound because of some of the things he wrote or said about Jews. A lot of people I know who love teaching theory struggle now with Paul DeMann because of his implication in fascism and Nazism in his early 20s. I'm curious whether it's as pleasurable for you reading and teaching Seneca, having immersed yourself, not just Thyestes, but say those serious moral Stoic works that are the basis of his great reputation for Montaigne, for so many great thinkers ever since. Is it as pleasurable for you to read those works of Seneca now, having wrestled with who this man was and how dirty perhaps his hands might have been in an untenable situation?
Well, I have to say it is. You know, Plato created this ideal of Socrates, a man who never felt ambition, who never had any desire for money, who always knew what the right thing to do was and did it, who was never tempted by anything. And, you know, that ideal has stuck with us for millennia. It stuck with the ancient world for centuries. But Seneca is the real deal. You know, he's the life that most of us lead. We're all tempted to do things that we know are a little bit wrong, but it's going to produce a great gain, or it's going to lead to some greater good down the road, or we have ways to justify it to ourselves. It's what all of us face in our daily moral lives, just in a more extreme form. So I find it actually very gratifying to teach it and to get my students to think about those kind of dilemmas before they face them. Most of them haven't faced them yet, but they will, and maybe they'll see them more insightfully.
What I love about this book is so much is at stake in it, in really which Seneca we believe in. What would you say to somebody who is not as generous as you are ultimately to Seneca, who says, why should I read this man if he could not live up to his own moral precepts?
It's a very fair question. I don't think I can tell someone that they should, because some people are more comfortable with the Socrates model. Some people really want the ideal leading them on, and even though they may fall short, they still can look to that ideal. I guess I would just, you know, what excuses Seneca for me from being an evil man, what redeems him is, number one, as you say, he didn't have choice a lot of the time. And number two, he recognized his own shortcomings and discussed them honestly as he could in his work. And he often has a tone of apology in his writings, as though he wants the Romans to know that he knows he fell short. And that goes a long way to me to humanize him and to make him sympathetic.
A couple more questions. I'm always interested in how a work is sits within different disciplines. And this is a book that's going to appeal to classicists, it's going to appeal to philosophers, and it's going to appeal to political scientists in different ways. How do you think classicists are going to respond to this?
Oh, I think they'll dislike it intensely.
I hope we have a few of them in the audience when we turn to Q&A. Why would they?
Well, I'm thinking of the community of Seneca scholars that I know and work with, most of whom treat Seneca as a moral philosopher, pure and simple.
A god.
Well, not as a god necessarily, but as a moral thinker, first and foremost, and the political career is secondary, if they even consider it at all. You know, the only other monograph on Seneca in English is called Seneca, A Philosopher in Politics.
That's the Griffith book? That's
Miriam Griffith.
Yeah.
That's her definition. He's a philosopher who happened to be in politics, you know. And that's really how most of my colleagues want to see him, in order to take him more seriously and to take his philosophy more seriously.
So are they going to turn your back on this, or do you think it's going to open up a conversation that really deserves to take place?
That's a good question. The reviews have yet to come in, but
okay.
I'm rather terrified. he does cut a huge amount of ice among modern philosophers who are willing to read his works in a vacuum.
So first classicists, then pure philosophers, people
yes.
who... how do you think philosophers are going to respond to this? Same way? Or, I mean, the affinity people feel who work on Seneca is so deep that they actually don't want the biography to contaminate.
Yes, that is essentially the reaction. You know, I compared the response that I think my book will evoke to the discovery of that 1813 bust. You know, we had this beautiful image of Seneca. It was very gratifying, and then suddenly this other thing comes out of the
earth. Ruins everything.
It ruins everything.
All right. In a lot of ways, it's like the de Man case, where, you know, we love this man, he was a brilliant professor, and then people keep turning up these terrible things he wrote in the 40s, and you try to exonerate or contextualize or, in a Derridean way, complicate, but that is what you're wrestling with.
Yes.
I would think that political scientists would be the most deeply indebted to this, especially those who think a certain kind of, and this is not your Seneca, but it's possible to find him in this work, a kind of precursor to Machiavelli.
Mm.
And, you know, that is really a possibility. A man who is close to power, singed by power, and understands how to navigate around that. But Seneca, unlike most philosophers, Aristotle might be the exception, is as close to power as any thinker gets. And
that
is thrilling.
Yes.
And also...
especially when he writes a work which is basically a treatise on the Roman Principates, on the powers of the new office of princeps that was only less than 100 years old in his time. He's the only theoretician who tried to articulate for the Romans what it was and why it was valid.
Right, and that's why I thought of that Machiavelli connection, just writings right out of that tradition.
That's right, yeah.
Before I turn it over to the audience, what are your two last questions really from me? What are your hopes for this book and the conversations in which it will shift the battle lines a little bit?
Well, I hope it interests a lot more people in Seneca, for one thing.
And it's written in a way that it absolutely will. So
yeah,
beyond
I tried to do that. I tried to make it tried not to create barriers to those who don't know Roman history, because it's deadly dull when an author has to explain what the various institutions of Roman government are and the military and so on. I try not to do any of that. I try to let the story tell it, fill in the details as it goes. So I hope as I hoped for Ghost on the Throne, that it just introduces people to a subject they might have found forbidding or, you know, felt outside of because of all the information that has to be mastered, but to show that there are people like us, very human people.
One of the things that I really loved about the book is most of us, especially those of us who are of a certain age, can feel what the 60s or the 50s or the 40s or the 30s were in the 20th century. And those of us who read Victorian novels can kind of get a sense of the 19th century. And those of us who study the 18th, 17th, 16th, 15th centuries can get a feel of these early modern or pre-modern moments. But you bring to life the first century. I don't really inhabit the first century. It must have been an awesome place where philosophers and insane dictators and apostles of Jesus are walking by each other in the streets of Rome. An incredibly influential moment of ferment and ideas that shape so many of our own political and moral and religious questions and attitudes today. So do you kind of live in the first century? Is that when you're not here with us? Is that where you are? Are you comfortable in the first century?
Only in this period, strangely enough. You know, I haven't investigated Augustus, who is the figure most historians go to, or Tiberius. For some reason, this period, mainly because of its literary style, because of the what's called Silver Latin style, which is a very modern, very contemporary, to my ears, very contemporary style, feels more at home to me than any other part of the first century. It's only 15 years that I cover, but the Neronian period, which was a literary renaissance, really, of a par with the Augustan age, but silver instead of gold, that part of it feels like home.
Well, you're a lucky man then. Let me open it up to questions rather than statements. Stand up, and if the rest of you can't hear it and make those mumbling sounds as I couldn't hear it, I will repeat the question and turn it into a question that I would have asked had I had more time. Fire away. I'll moderate the questions. Please.
So my reputation, Nero doesn't strike me anyway as the most Senecan of emperors or decision-makers. And Seneca clearly must have had some significant influence.
I'll rephrase the question. Don't worry about it. Go ahead. Keep going. Did you all hear that?
No.
I will repeat it. You can't be in a relationship with Seneca, as Nero was, for as long as he was, without, in a sense, either imbibing those lessons or not. So what lessons did Nero learn from Seneca, or was he simply a schoolboy who was the most powerful man in the world, who paid very little attention to this old man his mother saddled him with? Is that a reasonable version of that?
Even better.
Good.
He very quickly became an old man that his mother had saddled him with, and at that point his influence was lost. But I'd say for 3 or 4 years, Seneca's primary influence was to keep Nero from going off the rails any sooner than he did. He was like a restraining force. He couldn't really teach the man anything, I don't think. He had no head at all for Seneca's style of instruction. But as a exemplar or as a role model, he was able to keep Nero from singing in public, which is something he desperately wanted to do, driving chariots in public, from debauching himself any more than he did. He was a kind of, superego that Nero listened to for a while, at least partially, and then finally stopped.
There's probably a great, great collection of essays to be written about failed minds who tried to teach young people who would be powerful one day. I could think of several from Renaissance England, but obviously the great granddaddy is Seneca. The next question, please. Especially from disappointed classicists. Stand up and fire away.
Thomas More, dealing with Henry VIII.
Yes.
Did you think about that comparison?
Yes, very much so.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you consider it? They were quite different in that crazy than Nero was.
Right.
Did you all hear that question? It's more or less the same problem of the failed genius trying to impress upon a world-changing leader, in this case, More and Henry VIII.
Well, of course, Thomas More has the saving grace that he finally did stand up for his principles and refused to go along with, a debauched monarch and paid for it with his life. Seneca, unfortunately, never made that move. He had several opportunities, but didn't take them.
But how did he die?
He died forced to commit suicide, so in a sense executed, because he was linked to a conspiracy against Nero's life, even though he had declined to participate. The moment of crisis came. He was invited, almost certainly invited, because his nephew was a leading member, to join a conspiracy, and declined, but wrote a kind of a mildly encouraging note to the conspirators, which was then held as evidence of collusion, and so he was taken down with the others. He was really a victim of Nero's resentment more than he was a conspirator.
But can't that last moment, some of his life, be read as a one Kissinger-like move to many as he tries to play both sides against the other, hoping that he's going to rise to the top?
Yes, and what's even more enticing, what's even more intriguing about this moment, which I explore in as much depth as I can, given how little evidence we have, is that there was a group of conspirators who wanted to kill Nero, put another man on the throne, then kill him and put Seneca on the throne. And Seneca is said to have known about this sub-conspiracy. So he not only deferred from taking part, but was waiting in the wings to be installed in power if this plot succeeded.
The philosopher king.
The philosopher king, yes. It's a very complex moment. So he did not have his one shining moment in the sun the way that Thomas More did. Where I think they're most comparable, and I haven't really explored this much, but I know that Thomas More wrote a series of letters from the Tower of London when he knew that he would be put to death there. And the letters have, this very plaintive and poignant tone because, of course, they're the last communications of his life. And Seneca's letters, his epistles to Lucilius, I think occupy that same niche, that they're written under the threat of death. Seneca knows they're probably going to be his last communication, and he's trying to pull out all the stops, trying to win eternal glory in the in the realm of philosophy.
Next question, please.
Yes.
And I'm just curious if any of those speeches still exist and if you think that they should be considered part of the canon of Seneca's
writing. So the question is, in case you didn't hear it, among the vast writings that Seneca has given us are speeches he's written, including political speeches, hack speeches was my note in the margin, that he wrote for Nero along the way. Do we include this in the collected writings of Seneca, or do we keep that on the side as not really part of his true body of Stoic philosophy?
Well, none of them survive, so we don't have to make that choice.
And if they did?
If they did. Well, I do discuss two of them about which we know the contents. We don't have any of the words, but Tacitus preserves the contents of Nero's inaugural speech, apparently, to the Senate, which was a huge success and was actually inscribed on silver so that it could be read every year by the incoming consuls for that year, a kind of, you know, tour de force of humane rhetoric.
But the second one did not land quite as well.
The second one was the speech, the letter that Seneca had to write justifying Nero's murder of his mother to the Roman Senate and portraying it as a victory for the state and the banishing of a monstrous threat to the regime. And that caused such opprobrium in the Senate that some leading senators walked out rather than have to listen to it.
So it's not an easy, I mean, you can imagine an SAT set speech, you know. Somebody has just killed his mother. Write a speech defending that political action. It's just one of those tough genres. I don't know how you could have done that or sold that. Maybe the new SAT will have that as part of the postmodern moment here. There was another question from this side of the room. Yes, please. The question is, and this is a Coleman Center. For those of you who have not been Coleman Fellows, and the only reason I'm up here is in the hopeless attempt that I'll be allowed to be a Coleman Fellow one day without having facial surgery and an identity change and reapplying under a different name, because you can only be one once. But this is one of the world's great libraries. And within one of the world's great libraries, you get a wonderful office in the room adjoining, and you get books brought to you, and you get to look at treasures, and it is a thrilling experience because there are 15 other people sharing small offices with whom you exchange ideas every day. So the question is, as painful as it is, you it's been a number of years out for you as well. What did you see here that helped you write or reimagine this project?
You know, I can't say that I found any source materials here that I couldn't have found elsewhere. In fact, I sometimes had to go to Columbia for sources because the classics, but the community here of writers from all fields and the audience that is present when you're writing, I think that was the principal resource, that I was speaking not to my fellow classicists, but to writers and scholars from all disciplines, and even presenting to them here in this room at the bi-weekly lunches. So just having a sense of an audience that goes beyond one's own field, I think that to me was the... And also being in this building and, you know, seeing marble walls that Nero would have envied on a daily basis, I mean, that was a real thrill.
Next question, please. Stand up.
So Nero was one of the child emperors who sort of grew up with the power and glory, and most of those turned out really bad.
Yes.
Did Seneca ever have a chance of rescuing Nero from that fate, or is there just
That was a good question. I can't repeat it. It was so good.
Yes, well, for a young boy of 10 or 11 to be brought up knowing that he's going to have supreme power and be able to execute other people just by, you know, going like that, I mean, there's very little chance they're going
to turn out.
What's
left to learn?
Well. There's very little chance that they'll turn out well. And, you know, Caligula was a prior example. Caligula came to the throne at 25 and very quickly went insane. And Nero at 16, what chance did he have? I mean, it was a system until it became an adoptive system later under the Roman Empire when emperors would choose an adult male as their successor and adopt that man as their son. And that was a much better system. But the hereditary system, which forced young boys to think of themselves as autocrats, you know, that was a very deleterious system psychologically. So, no, I don't think Seneca had much of a chance. There's a story about Nero.
I think Seneca thought he had a chance.
I don't think he did, no. I think if he did, it was only for a day or two. Apparently Nero, when he was a young boy, before even Seneca came on the scene, was so infatuated with chariot racing that his tutors had to scold him, that if he couldn't stop talking about it, they were going to beat him. You know, he was that obsessed with the American Idol experience, the cheers of the adoring crowds, and which was what chariot racing was for the Romans. And when he grew up, that's what he wanted. He wanted to be in that place to get the cheers of adoring crowds.
And the theatrical side of him, you write about that. Could you share that with us just a bit?
Yes, well, he fancied himself a performing musician. And
was he any good?
He wasn't bad. Of course, he won all the prizes. So, he took it very seriously. He trained his voice day and night. And... he observed all the competition rules. You had to stand continuously and sing for hours at a stretch. You couldn't wipe your brow or sit down or drink water, any of those things. So he was extremely devoted to performing as a musician. And that's what finally got him ousted from power, that the army could no longer tolerate having this, you know, this absurd fop as their commander-in-chief. And so they rose up and overthrew him.
I mean, one of the great ways of reading this story is, following up what you just described, it's about this powerful young boy who just wanted to act and this brilliant philosopher who really wanted to rule the world. And neither of them got to achieve that ambition.
Yes.
There are copies outside of the book. I'm sure James would love to sign them. And I want to thank you all for coming. To think that New York can still pack a room to hear a discussion of ancient Rome is a very, very heartening thing. So I'm grateful for you all for coming and for Gene for creating such a wonderful and vibrant community for former and current and future Cullman Fellows. So thank you very, very much.